All right, winning number is 583-850. Do we have a winner? Do we have to draw again? No? They got to be here somewhere. Let's everybody look at the number. It's 583-850. We'll have to draw again. This is the first time for everything. Last time I was doing this MC job, the speaker didn't show up. At least we're down to the right ticket holder. Okay. How about 583-826? All right, we have a winner in the back. All right, you can claim your bread basket after this. All right, now to the introduction of our head table. All right. So, of course, we have the ambassador, Hussein Husana, and Phyllis will be making that formal presentation today. But at the far end of the table, we have Jonathan Wittes, who's a board member of the Alaska World Affairs Council. And, of course, Phyllis Smith will be introducing our speaker today. And Phyllis is going to now take the podium to give us a little background about the BEV Power and the BEV Power Memorial Program, which is today's program. So with that, Phyllis, can I have you do the introductions?
Some of you may remember BEV. Am I coming out at all?
You'll have to speak really closely.
I feel like a rock star now. As I was saying, some may remember BEV. She was a longtime active board member, leader of the council for many years. She gave very generously of her time and money, inspired others to do the same. Her major goal was to bring speakers with special expertise to address the council on matters of international concern. When she died in 1991, we set up a fund to honor her memory. This was called the Beverly Power Foundation. It was financed through contributions from the general membership. We hope to, by investing this money, to earn enough to bring a speaker, possibly annually, at least as often as earnings would allow. When her husband Jim, who was also active in the council, when he died, he left a substantial bequest to the Beverly Power Memorial Fund. This has enabled us to do an annual speaker who has special expertise. Such a speaker is Ambassador Hussein Husana. Now, he asked me if I was going to read a long, boring introduction. And I told him I had 13 pages and I'm reading every one of them. He suggested that I pare it down a little. So here we go. And it truly is my pleasure to introduce Ambassador Husana. Would you excuse me while I get my glasses?
It's one thing to say I'm going to read and another thing to be able to do it.
Ambassador Husana is chief representative of the League of Arab States to the United States. During a distinguished diplomatic career for Egypt, Ambassador Husana served as ambassador of the League of Arab States to the United Nations. And prior to this, he was at different times assistant minister of foreign affairs for international legal affairs and treaties, ambassador to Morocco, and ambassador to Yugoslavia. He has been a member of the Egyptian delegation to successive Middle East negotiations in Cairo, Tel Aviv, and Paris, and Washington, D.C. Previously, Ambassador Husana also served as Director of Cabinet to the Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs of Egypt, and was Director of the Egyptian Press and Information Bureau in Paris. Prior to that, he served in Washington, D.C. as political counselor at the Egyptian Embassy and was special advisor to the Egyptian Foreign Minister on Legal and International Organization Affairs. Even earlier, he was a member of the Permanent Mission of Egypt to the United Nations in New York. Ambassador Husana earned an LLB and PhD in international law from Cambridge University in the United Kingdom, an author of books and articles on international affairs and Middle East issues. His writings have appeared in such prints periodicals as the American Journal of International Law and World Policy. Ambassador Husana has lectured at major universities in the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, and France, and now Alaska. He's here today to speak to us on current challenges facing the Middle East, an Arab world perspective. Please join me in welcoming Ambassador Husana to our podium.
Good afternoon, everyone. Okay. That's better? Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the World Affairs Council to have invited me to come and speak here today. I really strongly believe that the World Affairs Council is a lovely institution, because it brings people together from different backgrounds and allows them to try and understand world problems. And today we live in a global world. Everything is interrelated, interconnected. And it's so important, I think, for people to get educated, to open their minds to other issues, not just the local issues. And I think the World Affairs Council does this. So I'm very happy that you're engaging in these activities. And thank you, Mr. Wang, for chairing this meeting, and also thank you for introducing me. When I told people in Washington I was coming to Alaska, they told me, oh my God, this is the end of the world. You're almost going to Russia. And it's not the right time of the year. It's cold. But I said, well, I committed myself 6 months ago to come and speak here. And it was also a way to get away from this debate in Washington over the budget and the government shutdown, which unfortunately is not the best way of settling issues, but I'm not sure what will happen if tomorrow everything will be shut in Washington and the federal government. I don't know if this will affect you here, but I know that it's something that has become so politicized, so partisan, that I think people should really try to solve this issue and find common grounds, because this is the common interest of the United States to settle this issue soon. But when I committed myself to come and speak to you 6 months ago, I said, they asked me what kind of title do you want for your lecture? And I said I will be talking about the current challenges facing the Arab world. Well, things have changed. We have a new Middle East. So I have to update my lecture now and tell you how I see things now in the region. There have been some historical changes and new challenges. So let me first tell you a little bit about myself. I am an Egyptian diplomat. I had a long career in the Egyptian diplomatic service, and then I was chosen by the Arab League to represent them. I spent some years at the United Nations, and now I've been in Washington for many years representing the Arab League, following Arab issues in the United States, but mainly trying to promote a better understanding between the American people and the Arab world. And I think this is very much needed, because people have to understand the issues more. We have to explain the challenges we have in the Arab world, and the United States also has to understand more what's going on in the Middle East. The Middle East is such an important region, not only for the United States, but for the whole world. So I've been trying to do this. I also try to coordinate the position of the members of the League, which, to tell you the truth, is not always easy, because there are different opinions and different positions. But we always meet among the Arab ambassadors. We go to Congress, we go to the State Department, we have some common initiatives, and not only political initiatives, but we have cultural initiatives, because culture is so important to bring people together. We have also economic initiatives. We get the business community from the Arab world together with the business community in the United States, and then people can really feel they have some common interest and something to work on. So there's a lot to be done, of course. I represent the Arab League now, and I tell you briefly what the Arab League is. The Arab League is a regional organization, just like the OAS, the European Union, the African Union. But it is the oldest one, because it was created already in March of 1945, just when the Second World War ended. And it started with seven member states that were the members of the League that were independent at the time. And over the years, it has enlarged, and now it has 22 member states. Some of them are in Africa, some of them are in Asia, North Africa. So it's a quite important organization. The Arab League has also evolved from being a political organization, mainly trying to coordinate the political positions of its member states. It has evolved to become a much larger organization. It has created many special organizations, like the United Nations, that has created special agencies in all fields, in fields of health, of agriculture, of energy, of labor, telecommunication, you name it. So it has expanded over the years. It has also played an important role at the United Nations, since it has been the Arab group at the United Nations is also member of the Non-Aligned Group. It's a member of the African group, the Asian group, group of 77, the developing country group. So it has quite an importance at the United Nations. And it works with other groups to try to develop the structure of the United Nations, to reform the United Nations, which we all are looking forward to, the United Nations being such an important, I think, organization in the world. In spite of its weaknesses and deficiencies, I think the United Nations is central to the world, because this is the place where everyone meets. It has 192 countries. They're all members of the United Nations, and they can work together to find global solutions to global problems. And all problems in the world today are global. So the United Nations, we believe, is important. It has to be reformed, and the Arab group there is trying to contribute to that reform. The Arab League has faced many challenges, like all other organizations. Challenges relating to bureaucracy, challenge relating to adopting many resolutions that are not implemented by member states, just like other organizations have faced the same problems, financial challenges. But it has tried to overcome those challenges by also undertaking some major reforms, changing the voting procedure, making it simpler, creating new institutions. I like creating another parliament, trying to create another court of justice, getting civil society more involved in the work of the League, just like the United Nations has done. So over the years, there have been many different new procedures and reforms adopted. Some people say, of course, the Arab League has not performed the mission which people had hoped for. But if you look historically, you'll see that all main initiatives adopted in the Middle East were done through the Arab League. Like in 2002, the Arab League has tried to put forward an important peace initiative trying to settle the Arab-Israeli problem, called the Arab Peace Initiative, that was presented at the summit meeting in Beirut in 2002, and that called for the Arabs to recognize Israel, to enter into normal relations with Israel, provided the Israelis, on the other hand, withdraw to the 1967 borders, recognize the Palestinian independent state, and agree to a just solution of the Palestinian refugee problem. So this is still on the table. It is an important framework, and it was adopted through the Arab League. The Arab League has also adopted an important agreement between the member states on creating a free trade zone, that will evolve over the years into a custom union and eventually into a free trade agreement and a common market, just like the European Union has done. So I think this is also an important step to try to integrate the Arab world. The Arab League has also put forward a proposal to create in the Middle East a zone free of all weapons of mass destruction. Because we believe that if you have countries like Iran who are trying to acquire nuclear weapons, the solution is to have all countries join a treaty where they abide by this zone of weapons of mass destruction, and where there are international supervision that can guarantee that no one acquires this. But of course, the Arab League also believes that Israel, who is known to have weapons of mass destruction, should also be part of that free zone of all weapons. So the Arab League has, I think, some importance. Let me now going to what I think is the main issue today in the region, and this is the uprisings that have taken place since the beginning of this year. Some people call it revolt. Some people call it revolution. Some people call it a new Arab awakening or the Arab Spring. But I would still stick to the term uprising, because it is uprising of the population against the governments and the leadership that have denied them the fundamental basic human rights, mainly the rights of freedom. So this is how I see it. It started in Tunisia, and I think we have a student from Tunisia here with this a street merchant who felt that he had been offended and that he set himself on fire and he died. And it led to a wave of protests of the people of Tunisia, which eventually led to the president of Tunisia leaving the country and the revolution taking place in Tunisia. And this in turn influenced the people in Egypt. In Egypt, it took place in a very dramatic way. It took place when the young people, the young generation, went to the street, to Tahrir Square. Tahrir Square now has become something that goes down in history. Whenever you have a head of state or a high official coming to Cairo, this is where they all want to go. We had Hillary Clinton, we had a lot of congressmen, we had Senator Kerry. They all come to go to this place where this revolution started. And how did it start and why? Let me first tell you that there were some common roots for all these events throughout the region. The common roots were that in the Middle East, there was a deficit of good governance, a deficit of freedom, also a deficit of poverty, a young population, many of them unemployed, and then the big gap between the rich and the poor. All these are really the root causes of what is happening in the Middle East. There's not a single cause. But it evolved in each country according to the local conditions. So the important thing is that when you try to understand what's going on in the region, you should not generalize. You should not say, this is the reason why it started, this is how it will end. There is a specificity in each country. Some of them are republics, some of them are kingdoms. Some of them are established old countries with institutions like, let's for instance say Egypt, and some of them are young countries like the Gulf countries. So each country is different. And I think the way these uprisings will develop or have developed depends mainly on how the leadership in each country deals with that. If the leadership responds to the aspiration of the people, if the leadership agrees to introduce more reforms, if the leadership is responsive to the needs and tries to understand the issues and responds accordingly, then this can be peaceful, like it has happened in Tunisia and in Egypt. But if the leadership responds through trying to crush this, using violence, I think it will get out of hand, as we've seen in Libya today. So each country is different. But let me just tell you about Egypt, not because I come from Egypt and understand well the problem, but also because what is happening in Egypt has and will affect the rest of the Arab world. Egypt is the largest country in the region. It has 80 million people. It has always been the country that has inspired the rest of the Arab world through its culture, through its religion. The Azhar University, which is the oldest university in the world, is in Egypt, and it has always influenced the rest, the Sunni world, through its teachings of Islam, moderate Islam, tolerant Islam, and not extremist Islam like in other countries. It has also led the region in time of war and in time of peace. When Sadat went to Jerusalem which led to a breakthrough in the peace talks and then to a peace agreement between Egypt and Israel. And then this was followed by a peace treaty between Jordan and Israel. And now, of course, we are all focused on trying to achieve peace between Israel and the Palestinians, which is a difficult challenge. It is a difficult challenge, and we need to focus on it. We need to find a solution, and I might come back to this. We need also American leadership in this. But I want to say that what happened in Egypt has influenced the rest of the Arab world. What has happened in Egypt? If you look at the revolution, you'll see that, first of all, it was the revolution of the young people. Using the social network, Facebook and Twitter and so on, and they were educated young people who did this. The other thing is, what they were calling for was not some local or extremist objectives. They were calling for universal rights, universal human rights, universal rights of freedom, that they thought they had the right also to have like others in the world. And then it showed that people all got together and there was a unity among all Egyptians, a unity among the Muslims, among the Christians, among the old generation, the young generation, all professions. They were there in Tahrir Square day after day for 18 days until the president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, accepted to leave the scene. And I must give him credit, because President Mubarak has done a lot for Egypt. He has brought stability to Egypt. He has preserved the peace between Egypt and Israel. He has tried to mediate between the different Palestinian factions. He has tried to counter extremism in the region. And when he saw that the tide was against him, when he saw that really the population wanted him to go, wanted a new leadership, a new democratic process, he decided to go. And this was, I think, the best development that happened in Egypt, that it was done peacefully. And the army also, which is a well-known institution in Egypt, did not go against the people. The army respected the will of the people. They did not use force. And of course, there were some minor incidents. But in general, the army decided that this is what the people of Egypt wanted, and this is what they were going to support. So they founded a council that is still now in charge. But they also decided that we need to proceed. And the army announced that they do not want to remain in power. It's not their job. They wanted to hand over power to the civilian administration. So now it has been decided that there will be parliamentary elections in September, followed by presidential elections in November. And there will be a new constitution drawn up where all different parties and factions of population will take part in order to create a new political democracy in Egypt. Is it easy? It isn't. I think democracy is always full of challenges because you have many opinions, you have many interests, and especially a young and fragile democracy like the Egyptian one is difficult. The economy has suffered, of course, because for many days everything was closed, the bank was closed, the stock market, the tourism has suffered, foreign investment has run away. So we are facing a difficult phase now. But still, there is a new spirit, a spirit of hope, a spirit of determination to create a better Egypt. And I think this will prevail at the end. And as a result of what has happened, you can see that the new awareness for the need to respect the rule of law, the need that there should be a strong and independent judiciary, the need that every citizen should feel equal before the law, and also the need that there should be transparency. There should be also accountability. And those who have committed crimes in the past have to be made accountable for that. It is not easy. And we are going through a phase, maybe like some countries went to in South Africa, where we need this kind of truth and reconciliation. Truth where everyone is responsible for what he did, but eventually I think the country has to unite again and to look to the future and not just go and settle accounts of the past. This is what I believe. So, as I said, the Egyptian Revolution has inspired already many other countries. You've seen events similar in Yemen. You see events in Bahrain. You see events in Syria. But they're all different because the societies are all different. Sometimes in Bahrain, one of the main reasons why you have these disturbances is that society in Bahrain is split between a Shiite majority and a Sunni minority. And the Shiite majority are asking for more rights against the ruling minority. So it is a different problem. Again, in Yemen again, and in Yemen it is a complex problem. Again, you have different factions. You have a tribalism. You have a leader that was there for many years. And I feel that the next country where there might be a regime change will be Yemen. And they're talking now about how the leader will leave, on which terms, and eventually there will be a new situation in Yemen. But the worst situation is the one in Libya. In Libya, we had a president, President Gaddafi, who over the years has played an important role in the region, in Africa, and in the world. He, after being accused of terrorism, of trying to develop nuclear programs, he has shifted and has tried to open up to the world. He has decided to abandon his programs of acquiring nuclear weapons. He has committed himself not to support any terrorism in the world. So he has changed, and the world has accepted this. And you have seen the relations between the United States, between the rest of the world, developing. In Africa also, he has played an important role, trying to settle many African crises, trying to unify the Africans around a new African Union, the organization that used to be called the Organization of African States, created in 1963, has been developed and evolved in a much closer and effective organization. And this was, to be objective, it was thanks to President Gaddafi who was behind that. But he has not responded to the calls and the wills of his people to have more freedom. And on the contrary, he has met this with threats. He has met this with mass killing. And this has led even his closest partners, the Arab countries, the Arab League. He's a member of the Arab League. And he has played an important role in the Arab League. But they have turned against him. And they have said, we have to protect the innocent people of Libya, the civilian population of Libya. You cannot deal with people like this anymore. And they have met, and at the first step, they have decided that Libya, as a government, can no longer take place in the activities of the Arab League. So, in fact, they have suspended the membership of Libya in the Arab League. The second step was, when he continued his threats, when he decided to crush the rebellion, when his forces started tracking down the opposition and in Benghazi, where this is their stronghold, then the Arab League has said, well, we have to intervene, but the intervention should not be by one state, the intervention should not be by a group of states, the intervention should be by the whole international community. So let's go to the United Nations. Let's ask the United Nations to impose a no-fly zone on Libya with one purpose, with the purpose of protecting the people of Libya. So it is only when the Arab League took that position that the United Nations met in New York, and after many days of deliberation, they adopted this resolution, resolution famous now, 1973, that called for a ceasefire, that called for the forces of Gaddafi to withdraw from the areas they have occupied, to stop the killing, and decided to impose this no-fly zone. But what is here very important, neither the Arab League nor the United Nations decided that Libya should be occupied, that ground forces should be sent to Libya. And they all called for preserving the unity and the territorial integrity of Libya. But even more important, they did not specifically call for the ouster of Gaddafi or regime change. They said this is something for the Libyan people to decide. So it's up to the Libyans to decide if they want to negotiate with Gaddafi, if they want to obtain their rights through peaceful means, if they want to go on fighting till they obtain their rights. It is up to them to decide and not for the international community. What has happened since is that, as you've seen, and if you follow the news, there's almost a stalemate. The Libyan forces have regained control of many areas. The opposition has trying to form a council that is seeking recognition from the international community. So far, only three states have recognized the opposition. France was the first one, and then Qatar, and Italy. A lot of people are wondering who this opposition is. Unfortunately, they have shown that they are not well organized, they were not trained, because these are just normal people. They are lawyers, they are physicians, they are businessmen who came together and stood up against Gaddafi. So they don't have the weapons necessary to defeat the forces of Gaddafi. They don't have the expertise and the training. So now the question is, what can be done? Will the international community help them? Will they just let them to see how things develop? They have been, of course, trying to punish the forces of Gaddafi, to prevent them to kill the opposition forces. And sometimes this has led to collateral damage. Some civilians have been killed. And I just saw today there was what you call friendly fire when the forces of NATO have attacked a group of opposition leaders. Instead of helping them, they have killed many of them. And this happens, of course, in all conflict situations, and it's very regrettable. So, of course, in the Arab League and the Arab world, people are beginning to feel sorry for the civilians that have been killed, and they wonder if this approach is the right approach. And we'll see what will happen in the next days. Will Gaddafi accept to leave the country? This is what the opposition is asking. They're not ready to make any deal. For them, a solution is only through the exit of Gaddafi and the formation of a new, free, and democratic government. But the Libyan situation is also very important, not only for the people of Libya. It's important for the whole region. Because if President Gaddafi is allowed to succeed, if he's allowed to crush the opposition, this will be sending the wrong messages to the whole region, to all other leaders who will see, well, maybe the only way now to face up to these uprisings is to use force and to crush it. So this is, I think, this is the importance of the Libyan situation. Another, from a another broader perspective, is the question of the United Nations that has intervened in Libya has done this on a humanitarian basis to protect the civilians. So there is a new concept emerging, although it is still controversial, that if in a given situation a country commits crimes, violates human rights of its population, does the international community have the right to intervene? And this is the concept that is developing now by many countries, but it is not, there is no consensus around it, because many countries still say, well, each country is sovereign and shouldn't intervene in the internal affairs of states. But many other countries say there is something called the duty to protect human beings if they are facing imminent danger of being attacked and their crimes against humanity and war crimes committed by government, then the international community will have to try to come to the help of the local population. Well, finally, I think I could talk on for hours on these issues, but let me just say finally that the international community response to the uprising in the region has so far been the right one, supporting the people, but not intervening, not trying to dictate how it should evolve. And I think President Obama was very wise when dealing with all these different crises. First of all, he dealt with them on a case-by-case approach and did not generalize, because he understood, as I said, the different scenarios and the specificity of each country. But he always said, he said this during the revolution in Tunisia, in Egypt, and in other countries, it is up to the people of the country to decide their own future. It is not up to us to tell them how to do it and to decide who their leadership should be. So I think this is a wise approach, because after all, these movements are homegrown movements. They did not come from outside. They were not supported or dictated from the outside world. They came from the societies themselves. So I think they have to retain this kind of autonomy and independence if they're going to be successful. I think that what the United States can do is, of course, to support the people who are in need now. For instance, in Egypt now, we have a big economic crisis. How to overcome this? And there were officials from the United States that have gone to Egypt, officials from Egypt that have come here, and they have tried to find ways to again promote tourism, for instance, which one of the main sources of our country. They have tried to find ways to maybe conclude a free trade agreement that would promote trade and exchanges. Also, they have tried to find ways to encourage investments again. They have tried to find ways to debt forgiveness, for instance, to Egypt by turning the debts which Egypt owns into investments in local projects, also trying to help in education, maybe in civil society, and so on. So there are many ways how the United States can play a constructive role, but always with the proviso that it should not be perceived as trying to dictate, to impose its own views on how the people of Egypt and the rest of the Arab world are going to decide their future. I think I gave you a little survey of what's going on. I hope it has helped you understand the situation. What is happening in the Arab world is important because the Arab world is so important. The Arab world is a region of over 350 million people. It has huge human resources, mainly young population. It has also an important strategic location in the world. It is the crossing of trade of links between Europe, Asia, the Mediterranean, and historically, of course, the Middle East is the birthplace of the main religions. It's the cradle of civilization. So it is important not only in today's terms but also historically. And what happens in the Middle East does affect the world. And I think today, maybe talking here in Alaska, I find that there are certain similarities between maybe the Middle East and the state of Alaska, which I have just discovered since I came here last night, being the largest state in the United States, which I didn't know, which is a rich state with so many minerals and oil resources. And maybe there should be some exchange between countries in the Middle East that have also oil and gas, just like you have here, to share experiences. I've talked to some people, and they said, yes, we have common problems, like finding a way of taxation, of dealing financially with the oil resources we have, of exporting them, of exploring them, and so on. So I would suggest that maybe one of your major universities can organize a conference and invite people from the Middle East to come here, and so there can be sharing of experiences that could lead, of course, to common knowledge and common interests. So on this note, I will thank you very much for listening to me and be ready to answer any of your questions.
Now, before you ask your questions, please wait until Carrie gets to you with the microphone. In fact, we're going to let Carrie pick the people who would like to ask questions. So, Carrie, questions are open right now, and you got the first one there.
You mentioned that the Egyptian uprising was nonviolent and peaceful, yet my understanding is at least 385 people were killed of the nonviolent protesters. We didn't intervene. In Bahrain, people are slaughtered by Saudi troops. We didn't intervene. Yemen, people are slaughtered by the U.S.-backed government. We didn't intervene. Yet we intervened in Libya, which started as a nonviolent uprising, was co-opted by an armed rebels, and that put the flame out to any nonviolent uprising that had a chance of overthrowing Gaddafi. Now we've got an internal civil war, yet we intervene on that sense. So there's a tremendous amount of hypocrisy. And you represented the Mubarak regime, which was repressive. Now you represent the Arab League, which is sponsored by, it's the dictators who are repressing the views of the people in your region. How do you say that you're speaking with an Arab perspective when you're representing the regimes that are putting the people down?
Well, first of all, I am not a politician. I'm a professional diplomat. And I represent the Arab League, which is an organization of sovereign countries and governments. And the policies of the Arab League are the ones which I try to explain. So the Arab League, as I said, is very much concerned about the developments. It has supported the change that is going on in the region. It has supported the will of the people. It is a new development that didn't exist before. And I'm trying to reflect those new policies. Libya, yes, the Arab League has seen that in Libya, the scale of violence was much more different than the scale. You mentioned in Egypt we had about 300 casualties. I mean, you cannot compare this with Libya, where there were thousands who were killed. So it's a different situation. And in many countries where you had this uprising and violence, you've seen the governments saying, we want dialogue with the opposition. We are ready for reform. We are trying to meet the needs. Some political prisoners have been made freed. But in Libya, it was different. The leadership of Libya has said, there is no dialogue. We will go from house to house. We will hunt down the opposition. We will crush them. So it's a different picture. That's why the reaction was different on the part of the Arab League. So I don't think you should just generalize and say there is hypocrisy because the Arab League dealt in one way differently from the others. And this is not only the position of the Arab League. I think this is the position of all the international community. The United Nations has taken a different approach. We all have to encourage more freedom in the Arab world, and not only in the Arab world. I think throughout the Arab world, there shouldn't be double standards at all. What is true today in the Arab world should also be applied to other regions in the world. It should be applied everywhere. Because human rights and universal aspirations are the same for everyone. For everyone, whether it's in the Arab world, whether it's in Palestine, whether it's in Asia, in Latin America, I think human beings have the right to have the same words everywhere. So I do not agree with you that there is this hypocrisy. Maybe it is perceived somehow. I know it's controversial. I know these issues are not black or white, but I think they're difficult ones, and people have to deal with them in a balanced way, in an honest way, and find solutions. And the most important is to save lives. The most important is that all these changes take place peacefully and not through violent means and using force. But thank you for your question.
Thank you. I would definitely like to take up your offer to collaborate with the University of Alaska on some conference or some workshop on economy and society, and we will do that. Coming back to your point, I think it was very interesting that the UN and the US and then later NATO all waited until they heard from the Arab League that the Arab League was speaking with one voice, that they did want some help with Libya for the reasons that you described. When you pointed out that Gaddafi should not be allowed to crush the people in Libya, do you think now that we need to hear again from the Arab League, or the Arab nations need to take some heightened role, because what NATO seems to be doing is perhaps helpful but not enough given the limitations of the opposition that you described? Or do you see any other role for the Arab states in the short term in Libya, and in the longer term in the rebuilding of these countries after the various uprisings that you described?
Well, I think that the importance of the Arab League is that it provides a collective view or a collective vision of how to deal with issues in the region, and this is normal. I mean, the same would be true for an African crisis. You have the African Union that meets. There are so many crises in Africa as well, and in Latin America there are so many crises, and it's for the people of the region that understand the issues, that know the root causes, that know the culture, the mentality. It's for them first to act and to tell the world, this is how we see it. So the Arab League has been doing this. For instance, let me just give you an example of a similar situation that has happened in 1990, when the president of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, invaded Kuwait. It was a big crisis, and the world did not know how to liberate Kuwait. And eventually, there was a coalition formed under the leadership of President Bush Sr. And this coalition was going to liberate Kuwait, but did not do so until it got the support of the Arab League. There was a meeting of the Arab leaders at the headquarters of the Arab League in Cairo, and they decided that this was an Arab country that was invaded by another country, and it was now time to find a way to liberate this country. And it is only when the Arabs adopted this position that many members of the League, among them Egypt, Syria, and Saudi Arabia, decided to join their forces and be part of this revolution, of this coalition that eventually liberated Kuwait. And the position of the Arab countries at the time was, we take part in this coalition for one purpose only, is to liberate Kuwait. We are not going to go with you to invade Iraq, but we have to, the purpose should be to liberate Kuwait. And this is what happened. So the Arab League gives what we call Arab legitimacy to any action or intervention. Just like the United Nations gives international legitimacy when they adopt a resolution of support to a country. So I think this is the importance of the Arab League. How the Arab League will deal with the Libyan situation or with the uprisings, they have adopted a series of resolutions criticizing the governments, for instance, the governments of Yemen, how it deals with suppressing the opposition there. In Libya, they have expressed concern about civilians being attacked. It depends how things develop, honestly. I would think that we have to see how the opposition there will gain the momentum again. We have to see what kind of response also President Gaddafi has to these events. So the Arab League will deal with the situation as it goes along. I don't think it has a clear-cut position. Its immediate concern is the fate of the civilian and the civilian population who should not be killed and suffer out of the conflict. But how the political situation will evolve, what kind of agreement will happen, again, the position is it is up to the people of Libya to decide. Please. Oh, okay. Oh, you are the leader, yeah.
Kari's the boss.
Okay.
I have a question. I was watching the news yesterday, and I saw a disturbing development in Egypt where the young women who stood side by side with the men are now being told to go home and cook and clean. What do you think the next revolution is going to be in Egypt? The women revolting, or how will Egypt handle that?
Well, of course, it might be women's revolution. But as I said, this is what's happening when you open the door to more freedom of expressions and you have a real democracy emerging. You have some people who are more conservative than others. Some people who are more liberal than others. But believe me, I know Egyptian women. They're strong, and they will not let themselves being oppressed by men. They know how to fight. The role of the woman is so important in not only in Egypt, in every society, because she's the mother. She is the housewife. Many of the women are also now having profession. Not in every country in the Arab world, but in countries like Egypt, like Tunisia, like Morocco, women play an important role. You know, once there was a statistics, and we found that in the Egyptian diplomatic service, we had more women ambassadors than the United States had. So it shows you that our women are pretty progressive.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
I'm so happy that the World Affairs Council invited you to Anchorage, Alaska, and we are actually international community in Anchorage, Alaska here, and we are actually home more than like 2,000 Arabs and Muslims here, and we are always proud to be Alaskans, also home from home too. And we have actually connected with the University of Anchorage, Alaska, and with the Alaska Pacific Universities in many programs too. My question to you, how do you see the Middle East from 5 to 10 years from now? Thank you.
Well, I don't have a crystal ball. I see it a much better place than it is now. Because I think what's happening now is like an earthquake. I mean, you're used to earthquakes, I guess, in Alaska. But it is a political earthquake. There will be a new political order in the region, where regimes will be much more democratic, where the people will have much stronger voice, where you will have stronger institutions. And as I said, the Middle East is very rich in its human resources, in its economic resources, in its talent. You know, just by, there were so many people who were awarded Nobel Prize in the region. You have, one of them is Mohamed Baradei, who is a friend of mine. He's a diplomat now, and he's running for president, who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize when he was head of the International Atomic Agency in Vienna for many years. Another one is Ahmed Zuhail, who was an Egyptian who works at Caltech in California. Another one is Naguib Mahfouz, a very famous novelist and writer who you might know about. President Anwar Sadat, of course, is the man who broke the stalemate in the Middle East, who went to Jerusalem and said it's about time that we have a lasting peace in the region. So many people from the region have great achievements. So I am hopeful. It doesn't mean that we don't have difficulties and challenges. I think one of the greatest challenge is still to find a just and lasting peace between the Arabs and the Israelis, and it is a difficult situation because I think that internal politics in Israel and also in the Arab worlds have an effect on the outcome. In Israel, to be honest with you, you have now a right-wing government that believes still in the policy of creating more settlements in the occupied territories, which is a country, which is a position which the United States has long objected to. But on the other hand, there will be some hopeful signs. 2 days ago, a group of prominent Israelis, ex-military leaders and security leaders, have put forward a proposal, trying to meet the proposal of the Arab League on peace. And saying, well, we know how we can settle all these issues, of territory, of Jerusalem, of refugees. They have been discussed for years. We know the solutions. Why don't we move on? So I think there is hope. There is hope, but there's a political will, and sometimes internal politics, of course, are an obstacle to progress. So I think Iraq also has gone out of many difficult years. The United States will withdraw completely from Iraq this year. Iraq has gone through a political process that has led to democracy. They had free elections. The Arab League was one of the organizations that was monitoring the elections. And I went myself in Virginia when the Iraqis abroad were voting, and I saw how proud they were for the first time to cast their vote and to choose their representatives. So Iraq can be a success story. You know, I can see Sudan. Sudan was a. If I had come 6 months ago to speak to you, I would have talked to you about the president, the conflict in Sudan. But Sudan again has peacefully settled the issue between North and South. The South has taken part in a free referendum. They have decided to secede. Now we will have two Sudans by June. We'll have a North and a South, and the importance is to help them to live as good neighbors, to share their resources, to live in peace and stability. So again, this in the future can be a success story. And Sudan is the largest country in the Africa. It is extremely rich in water resources, in agricultural resources, in crops, and so on. So if there is a new democratic system there and good relations between North and South, I think also it can be very helpful for the rest of Africa. So I'm hopeful. But again, I think the region also needs more, not only economic help, yes, but I think it also needs to focus on issues like education. Because in my mind, education is the key to progress. And this is true not only in our region, it's true in the world. You must have a quality of education. You must invest more in education. You must in scientific research. You must have, that is why I think it's so important that there is this exchange between academics, between students in the United States and the Arab world and the rest of the world. Because it's only through this that we can improve education and teach people how to live in a global world. So there are many challenges, but I think with goodwill and with international cooperation, I think we can hope to have a better lifestyle for the people in the region.
Okay. Well, Mr. Ambassador, we are honored to have you taken the time to come all the way from Washington, D.C. to visit us. And on behalf of the audience and the Alaska World Affairs Council, we'd like to give you just a short gift of Alaska memorabilia to entice you back one more time. And before we adjourn today, I just wanted to call everybody's attention to next week's program. Will be Friday, and it'll be Dr. William Meineke, historian at the U.S. Holocaust Museum Memorial, and it'll be moderated by David Gonstein, the founder of the Dynamic Capital Management. The doors will be open at 11:30, so we invite you all back. And please RSVP, if you can, to help us have a good headcount. With that, thank you for joining us today.
I covered the incredible ground, I guess.